I have some totally unprepared remarks to make. I mentioned to Nick that during the discussions several times, some of the work that we have done at RCA was mentioned, and I asked him whether he thought it'd be appropriate if I said something, and he said, perhaps if there is time, should do it. And I just learned at lunchtime, when I was eating lunch, that I was supposed to do it for 15 minutes. So pardon me if it's not very coherent. First, I would like to express my appreciation to Nick and Walton for the marvelous meeting that we have here. I think this was a marvelous experience. It was a marvelous experience to be in the computer field all these years and to relive it, so to speak, this week with so many prominent people who were actors in it. The way we entered into the computer field at RCA is through the initiative of Colonel Simon from the Frankfurt Arsenal in Philadelphia in 1939, who approached RCA with the proposition that Hitler had a great dominance in the air and the Allies were very poor at anti-aircraft fire control, and while the guns could shoot the planes, it was very difficult to aim them with the then mechanical directors. And he said, could you people who are wizards in electronics do something to direct the guns electronically? And he had enough foresight to say that there were two approaches, one which was what we would call digital, which would be based on the then existing cosmic ray counters, and two, which he called continuous and that we now call analog, which would be sort of an imitation of what was done mechanically. And so we undertook to do that. In fact, I was the first man to start working on it. And I can't remember whether we started before or after the invasion of Poland, but it was just at the very beginning of the war. And my first inclination was to start in the analog way, in imitation of the mechanical directors, but I soon found out that making anything that works with a precision of 1% was a practical miracle, and to do it at any speed was a double miracle. And so since the equations obviously required far more precision than that, I went on the digital approach quite soon. Shortly, I was joined by a few others, among others, Dick Snyder, whose photograph was shown here yesterday, Flory and Morton, and then another man by the name of Vance continued the analog approach, and his analog approach eventually resulted in a machine called the Typhoon, which did see a little bit of field shooting during towards the end of the war. But I'll talk about the digital part only because that's the only part that really had an important sequel after the war. During the early work on the digital computers, we thought that we had to make arithmetic units, first of all, and we had to do what is called today logic. We called it switching then, general switching. And so we conceived a lot of the decoder, coders, logical switch, and ORs, and all of that stuff. And also we built others, multipliers, and we had a fight within ourselves as to whether it was better to make them AC or DC coupled. And we made both varieties worked quite well. Also, it was quite apparent that we needed function tables, say ballistic tables for the gun, and so I first tried the miserable approach of using a cathode ray tube and putting curves and photocells, and of course that's terribly difficult because you have to make an A to D conversion, which is very difficult. And so that's when I thought of the resistive matrix arrangement that somebody made, Arthur Burks already made gave an anecdote about von Neumann saying it was a monster short circuit. So we developed that. Now the resistive matrix is today a forgotten device, but it's simply a matrix in which you put a resistance or not at every position when you wish a zero or a one. And then you simply excite the column, let's say, and you read the things on the rows or vice versa. And if you put the impedance is sufficiently low on the inputs and sufficiently high in the matrix, why the stray paths within the matrix can be avoided, in effect. The subsequent story is that von Neumann became a consultant to our project, and he became very familiar with all the work we are doing, and he we were asked, in effect, to undertake what became the ENIAC. And I wouldn't be surprised that von Neumann had something to do with this, although I don't know that this for a fact. But Hermann Goldstein was a very frequent visitor because he was the officer who was directly monitoring our project. And von Neumann was also not quite as frequent a visitor, but nevertheless, we had him very many times. So I had both the opportunity and the great life chance, really, to be associated with him from those years on. And unfortunately, as far as I personally am concerned, we decided at RCA not to undertake the ENIAC job. And the year was approximately 43, a date that I just confirmed with Professor Brainard in the bus on the way here. I thought it was 42, but he tells me it was 43. At that time, one of the reasons we thought that that undertaking such a thing as the ENIAC would be very difficult was, of course, the huge number of tubes and the failures that would result. So we did think of a tube in which you could do all the arithmetic in a single tube, which was called the computron. And when I explained this to Warren Weaver, who was then head of the NDRC, he was fantastically fascinated with it, so he immediately gave us a contract. And so we worked on that, and that was a tube in which all the parts of an arithmetic unit, both for multiplication and addition, were all interconnected internally, such that when you put the two terms of the arithmetic, the result would come on with all the interconnections made internally with no resistances, all coupled by secondary emission mechanism and by internal electrodes. You can call it a fantastic exercise in integrated vacuum technology. What happened was that we did make four cells work, but we also realized that this was a very difficult exercise. Now, we also had some contacts with the Moore School, and they came to visit us. We also came to visit them. We exchanged all the information we had. This was the mood then was, as somebody mentioned, a mood of great patriotism, and everything was done for the war effort, and so there was no questions of any taking anything back or any patents or anything like this. And so all the information we had, we freely discussed with the Moore School at the time. Then there was a hiatus in which we did nothing, and that was from 43 till after the war. After the war, we had in the meantime moved from our Camden headquarters to Princeton. Von Neumann, who knew us well from his consulting, had in mind making the IAS machine, approached us, and then eventually, after some negotiation, the decision was made that we would undertake the memory part, and he would do the rest at the Institute. And then, at that time, we conceived the Selectron tube, a name, by the way, that we are forbidden to use because it was a trademark of some counter or something that was found, so the lawyers don't let me use it, but so we call it the selective electrostatic storage tube, but nobody would understand it if I said that. And that was a tube which was the first purely digital with no analog stuff in it at all, memory, high-speed memory, in which one bombarded a set of grids like so, and then excluded all the electrons except in one window as a method of addressing. And then as a method of storage, one then utilized the fact that the whole range of electrons could in fact be there if one let the electrons go through all the windows, and utilized the fact that the currents could then maintain the floating storing elements to one or two stable potentials that they assume when they are bombarded by a steady state of electrons. And there are two ways of being poor, you know. One is to simply reject all the money it gets to you, and the other is to spend it as fast as you get it. And there are two stable ways of never having any electrons, and those are perfectly stable. So we use that principle. Now we eventually developed the tube. However, our friends in Princeton became somewhat impatient, and they undertook to use the Williams tube. However, the selectron was eventually produced by RCA and used in the Jarniak, which was made at the Rand Corporation. When I looked in retrospect, I can't say that we did so badly, because we started the tube, I think it was in 45 and 46, I can't really get the memory, and we stopped it in 49. So, and then we were in production in 51, and in today's date, and if I consider that the whole effort we had at the lab was three people, I put this in perspective of how many people put today to make a miserable CMOS transistors, you know, like they spend $10 million to do that, just a little thing like this. I don't think we did it so badly. On the other hand, I can't blame Julian here of being a little impatient at the time, because he wanted to have something to cook with in his machine. But, you know, if you have the advantage of the hindsight now. So that was the selectron. And the company made about 2,000 of those tubes. And I can't remember, but there was another place where the tube was also used. And for the life of me, I can't remember who it was. There were two outfits that had systems that they developed very well. The one at Rand is the one that I'm very familiar with. Then at that time I conceived the core memory, and I think the story of the core memory is well known. As you know, there was an independent invention at MIT. The core memory became a very great thing. However, we worked on the core memory quite a while, and in fact stopped the work on the selectron because of the core memory appeared to us much, much more promising. And also, subsequent to the core, we developed a gadget we called the transfluxor, which was a non-destructive readout core, and which led to a great deal of work in magnetic logic, which magnetic logic could be used without diodes or transistors and became extremely reliable. And in the countries of Eastern Europe, particularly in the Soviet Union, this became extremely popular, because they were not very strong in transistor technology for a long time. When I made a trip on behalf of IEEE years later, I was quite a hero there, because they had developed a device to control many industrial processes and the like. In this country, the transfluxor was completely eclipsed by the development of transistors. I'll take advantage of 1 minute and skip everything that happened afterwards, which was mostly RCA going to commercial work, and we did it like many other people. We were in the problems of software and hardware and all the inputs and outputs, and like everybody else, we had to make millions of decisions, many of which were wrong and many of which were right, and like everybody else. But I would like to take an advantage to switch from the past to the future. And since we have an assembly of so many eminent people, to say that it's quite true that by and large, the hardware in computers is darn good. And it is perfectly true that the most exciting things in computers are the ones that many people here are engaged in, is the development of languages and applications of computers and the like. However, it is my contention, and I think the contention of some people in the government, that there is one thing in hardware that's still miserable, and that's the memory. And despite the fantastic success of semiconductors and the marvelous success of magnetic recording, we are living in a world that's highly undesirable, namely mechanical recording with serial recording and running like hell, mostly with things that you don't want, being extremely smart to try to put them in some kind of an order which somehow you like, but spending a lot of intellectual effort doing this, which you really shouldn't do, and then combining this with something that's really good, which is a semiconductor memory, which at the moment is too expensive to use in the quantities you would like for mass memory. So this, to my mind, presents a challenge, an intellectual challenge of fantastic interest, that is an exceedingly difficult problem, and it's a challenge that's worth the great universities of these countries, I think, both in the physical sciences and in the systems and inventive sciences. And I'm merely repeating some of the pleas that some of the people in the government are making, but I think this is just as good a place to make that bit of propaganda as any. Thank you very much.
Are there any questions? Sir.
Erskine, CERN, Geneva, Switzerland. Two very quick historical questions. What kind of arithmetic was used in this digital fire control computer? Was it binary or was it decimal? And the second question, can you remember approximately when von Neumann became a consultant to the project?
First answer is binary. To the second, to the best of my recollection, 40, 1940.
Additional questions?
Well, thank you.